Prepare yourselves. I have a message from the masters of microdosing themselves, our longtime sponsor, Lumi Labs. Do you need a little help sleeping, or maybe you just want to maintain a nice level of calm throughout the day? Well, Lumi Labs has got you covered. If you're stressed out or your mind likes to run a million miles a minute, then you might want to give Lumi Gummies a try. They offer indica, sativa, and hybrid gummies that are designed to be taken in smaller doses to maintain a level of calm throughout the day. Or if you just want the pleasant sensation of being just a little bit stoned, you can take just a couple more and you're good to go. Myself, I like to pop a Lumi Gummy before bedtime, and that helps me fight off insomnia and the awful, dreaded, dusk till dawn vampiric sleep schedule that my body likes to default to. And the best part is you can get them sent straight to your door no matter what the marijuana laws are where you live. So check out microdose.com and see their wares. If you decide to pick something up, make sure to use the code KINGCAST at checkout to get 30% off and free shipping. That lets them know their ads works, helps the show, and you get a nifty discount in the process. So that's microdose.com, code KINGCAST. And that just leaves our corporate overlords. Yes, Fangoria has been at it for over 40 years, and they are better than ever. This magazine is not only gorgeous, it's highly collectible, and it's delivered right to your door 4 times a year. Each issue filled the room with articles exploring every nook and cranny of genre filmmaking, past, present, and future, with all the most exciting journalists, filmmakers, and horror know-it-alls to guide the way, including little old me from time to time. This high-quality writing will only ever appear within the physical pages of the magazine, so if you want to join in on the fun, well, you're going to need to subscribe. And in order to do that, all you got to do is head on over to Fangoria.com and sign up. And guess what? If you use the code KINGCAST at checkout, you are going to save a whopping 25% off of your subscription. That's Fangoria.com, code KINGCAST. Use it. Now on with the show.
Hi. My name is Stephen King.
He's gonna break!
Bedlam!
Bedlam! You guys wanna go see a dead body?
Well, sometimes that is better.
Hello and welcome back to the KINGCAST on the Fangoria Podcast Network. I'm your host, Eric Vespi, and today we are going to lay chili, as the master might say, as we dive into Stephen King's short story, Grandma. Joining me for this chat is the screenwriter behind tons of TV you've likely watched over the years, including My Dead Ex, Suburgatory, Blue Mountain State, and Mr. Pickles. And coming next January, he has a film out that he wrote and directed called Companion, starring Sophie Thatcher, Jack Quaid, Rupert Friend, and Harvey Guillen. Did I say his name right? I think I said his name right.
Harvey Guillen.
Guillen. I came very close to not fucking that name up. Harvey Guillen. I love that dude. Big fan of What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah, he's great.
The trailer's out for that right now, and it's a doozy. Check it out if you haven't seen it. It's coming this January, I believe. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Drew Hancock to the KINGCAST. Welcome, Drew.
Hello. Thank you for having me. Like, I'm just a big fan, and so I'm so happy to sit down and talk about Stephen King for, you know, however long you can stand.
7 hours. We're going to do.
I could do it too.
We are going to make the Iliad of Stephen King podcasts.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I could spend an hour just talking about the ABC miniseries. That was a big part of my childhood.
Yeah. And it's crazy how that, I think there's moments, especially when you're doing a show like this and you're like looking back and hyper analyzing King's work and output. There are multiple like moments over the course of King's career where, for whatever reason, he has made all the right choices to keep himself like the brand Stephen King, the biggest thing in horror or the biggest thing in publishing and whatnot. And part of that, I think, one of the big ones is his embracing of that kind of long lost art form now of the miniseries and on TV, because it became a cultural touchstone for so many people. And it's a thing that doesn't fully exist outside of maybe sports now. You know, I can think of the recent, even though the fight sucked, you know, the Tyson Paul fight, you know, that was something that everybody was watching and talking about, like, you know, around the water cooler kind of thing, you know?
Yeah.
And we just don't get that a lot anymore. With all the great freedoms that streaming has brought us and the internet and whatnot, and having whatever we want to watch at our, you know, a click away, depending on which subscription service you're signed up for. One of the drawbacks to that is that kind of lack of that shared communal experience, and that's something those ABC miniseries just knocked right out of the park.
There
wasn't anybody on the playground not talking about it when that came out. Anybody not talking about The Stand, you know.
Although I might be the only person that watched The Langoliers and loved it when I was a kid, so I felt like I was kind of on an island with that one specifically. But yeah, the it and Stand, and then, you know, to a lesser degree, The Shining. Those were for me, those were my big, those were in the summertime. Like, talking about Stephen King, I'm realizing, like, my brain is very, I don't know if you get this a lot, but my brain is really fuzzy because he's been such a big part of my life. And I'll go back and rewatch or reread like stories and his novels. And a lot of my friends growing up, loved King too. So my memories are like, I feel like I'm stealing memories from like friends sometimes about them being like, oh, I was here when I watched like this part in it. Mm. And I'm curious if that's something that's just specific to me, or you get that a lot, like, he's just such a big part of my life.
Yeah, I mean, that I do, but I also think that's just how memories work now. Mm-hmm. When you start getting when you start getting old, the memory becomes way fuzzier. I spent like all my formative years writing for Ain't It Cool News, and you know, I took part in, you know, a guy was doing a podcast series of like kind of trying to document the history of that site, and I think I was a frustrating interview because I'm like, I was there for everything and all these stories you're talking about, and I'm like, I don't remember. It's like, maybe. It's like, here's what I remember this happening, but it doesn't sound exactly like what all the other people are saying about it.
Yeah.
And so then you start understanding like, oh, so that's, you know, when I get judgmental of people in documentaries or whatever, and they're talking about, you know, this crazy thing that they survived or whatever, and there's multiple different points of view, I'm like, just get your story straight. And I'm like, well, shit, I guess everybody's living their own reality. I know a lot of my early childhood memories, I think, are my memories, and then I'll like flip through an old family photo album and realize that I, you know, maybe when I was 10 or 11, I was like looking at photos of me from certain, you know, points in like 2, 3, 4 years old or whatever, going, shit, do I actually have a memory of this, or do I just remember my childhood self looking at that and having a memory of it, or thinking I'm having a memory of it, you know? I don't know.
Yeah, no, it's fascinating. I mean, I've heard that every time you like pull up a memory, you're changing that memory. So my relationship with Stephen King is very complicated, and I'll have long bouts where I just won't like read anything by him, and then something will pull me back, and then I'll just find myself like rereading The Stand and like recently I reread The Stand and It
The Doorstoppers.
The Doorstopper, Talisman. And right now I have the big blind spot in the early 2000s, late 90s.
Yeah.
And I didn't even know that The Black House existed, and I saw it in a bookstore, and I'm reading that now. It's a slog. It's hard to get through. I'm not really enjoying it, but it's a book.
Yeah. It's a rough era for King for me well. But also I will say the show has kind of forced me to reexamine a lot of that stuff too, and I find that I appreciate it a lot more than I did on the first blush.
Yeah.
You know, stuff like Rose Matter, you know, which I just kind of read and discarded, you know, and it didn't really stick with me. Like, although I will say I've always loved Insomnia. For whatever reason, Insomnia was the weirdness of that book. It shook a lot of people off. But I remember at the time reading it and just being so over the moon with all the Dark Tower nods and just like kind of so in love with that, the whole concept of you know, an old dude, you know, becoming younger and all that stuff. I don't know. Grabbed me.
That's actually the first Stephen King novel I read.
No shit.
It's Insomnia. Yeah. So
I just stepped on your Stephen King origin story question. I haven't even asked.
No. My origin story is actually farther back, but I started with the short stories, and but the first book that I read was Insomnia. And I remember as a, you know, early, like it would have been probably middle school, I remember just like being like, when is this old person going to die? And we get to the main character. Like, I was like so disappointed that I was reading a movie about an elderly man, or a book about an elderly man. I remember that affecting me, but I got through it. And I, you know, like, I'm glad I did, cause I really loved it. As soon as like the little men in the yellow raincoats showed up, I was hooked.
Yeah, the little bald doctors. Yeah. Yeah, no, and there's a really great segue into our topic already here where we can talk about King and writing elderly people.
Yeah.
But I'm going to pin that for just a second because I do have to get your Stephen King origin story out of the way. But again, before I even ask that, I just want to follow up and say that I totally get it. You're not missing a whole lot from that era. You're going to have to skip an era of King.
Yeah.
I mean, there's some bangers. I mean, obviously On Writing is one of the best things he's ever put out, and that came out in that era. But for his fiction stuff, it took him a while to get his feet back under him after his accident. And and I think he also kind of had to birth the remainder of the Dark Tower. There, you know, it looking, this might not be how it actually was, but just looking at his output post Dark Tower, it feels like he relaxed. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's like he put those books out and then he just went, fuck it. I'm doing crime shit now, babies. You know, I got nothing left to lose, you know?
Yeah.
When
did he get hit by the van? Was that 90?
That was 99, I think.
99. Yeah. Okay. Well, that makes sense because I do remember getting pulled. Like I left him for a while and then I came back. Was it because there was that giant gap when it was between Wastelands and Wizarding Glass, and then Wizarding Glass had come out and I read it, and that to this day is still one of my favorite experiences reading that. I think it's one of his best books. That and Wolves of the Kala, to me, are like two of my favorite books of his.
Nice.
And those are both pre van crash. Is that true?
Wizarding Glass is. Wolves came out after. Wolves, like, he did Wolves, Song of Susanna, and Dark Tower, like, all back-to-back. Yeah.
Got it.
Yeah, because I think, well, and I've said this before, and I still feel guilty about it, but, like, when I heard that he got hit by the van, my very first response wasn't, like, or my reaction to it wasn't, like, oh, man, I feel so sorry for him. I hope Tabby's okay. I hope, you know, I didn't think about him personally. I said, oh, fuck, I'm never going to know what happens at the end of Dark Tower.
Yeah.
It's like, he's never going to finish this thing. And I think that the thing that probably scared him too, the accident. And he, you know, of course he rolled that into the books and whatnot. But it did feel like that was just like, I got to get this stuff done. And then anything after it's gravy, and all the stuff that he's put out after that, the quote unquote gravy, is just like some of his best work. You know, I haven't loved everything he's put out, you know, since, you know, 11/22/63, but like pretty much 11/22/63 is like kind of him reminding everybody that, like, yeah, I'm really the best at this. So, you know, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that, I think that actually might be, I think that might be his best non Dark Tower book, 11/22. I don't know if that's a hot take, but, I really enjoyed that one. And I thought The Institute was good too.
Yeah, no, that's one that I'm looking forward to revisiting. I've only read it the one time when it came out, and that was one that Scott had never read. So I was like, I was looking forward to the eventual day where somebody was going to pick it and force Scott to read like fucking 780 pages or however fucking long that thing is. But he wormed his way out of that deal, I guess. But but I'm looking forward. I'm looking forward to revisiting that one because it's got all the little stuff that I love about King. You know, it's like, the child protagonist, the children with powers protagonists, you know, the shop, the evil adults that run everything. It's also really interesting looking at that now in the age of Stranger Things and just how much, you know, it just lays bare the how much the Duffers like draw from King when you start looking at him revisiting like stuff from his past. Cause this is, if people don't know, it's kind of an extended shop story to him revisiting the people that ran all the experiments and shit and Firestarter and whatnot. So, which is very much the Papa, you know, telekinesis bullshit from Stranger Things.
Yeah, which I remember Stranger Things came out and then it came out after it. And there was like people that didn't know. They were like, oh, my God, it's ripping off Stranger Things. And it's just like, no, Stranger Things ripped off it.
It's just that meme now. It's like, you stupid slut. There was no Stranger Things when it came out. Let's grab your Stephen King origin story, because I feel like we kind of keep dancing around little bits and pieces of your origin story. Let's just get it out there in the open.
Sure. Yeah. So it's like two parts, I would say. My introduction to Stephen King was just by like just being on a playground and hearing his name and being associated with all things horror. And so just that name Stephen King was already just, it scared the shit out of me as a kid. And I remember my sister, this is like early grade school. My sister had a copy of Skeleton Crew with the one with the monkey on the cover. And I didn't read it, but I remember taking it and putting it in my room and just being like, the book itself just represented this like tome of like, this was, it was almost like I was, I don't even know what the word would be. Like I was challenging myself if I could keep this book in my room, and I was never planning on reading it. No intention of ever like, you know, opening it up and reading one of the pages, but just this thing, and it had its power on me like immediately. And so then the first time I'd ever read Stephen King was, I wasn't a big reader when I was a kid. And so in middle school, I remember my mom took me to, I'm from Omaha, Nebraska, and my mom took me to this bookstore called B. Dalton Bookstore. And I was just there, it was like just hanging out as my mom was shopping. And she said, you can go, look around, any book you want, as long as you read it, I'll buy it for you. I was like, really? Any book? She's like, yes, any book. If you are going to like sit down and read this book, yes, I will buy it for you. So I walked around and
grabbed the Kama Sutra.
Exactly. I think the only rule she said was it couldn't have pictures on that. So I wouldn't have been able to, it couldn't be a picture book. So I couldn't have grabbed that, unfortunately. But I think I immediately went to the Stephen King section. It drew me in, and I just, you know, combed through the titles and just picked one at random. And the one that I picked was Night Shift. And so this would have been like early 90s, and I still actually have the book. Like I have it right in my hand right now, that the one that I picked. I don't even think that I thought that she would let me buy it. I think I was kind of testing the boundaries of what the limits of like her little test for me was. And so I took it to her, and she was like, okay, if you read it, I'll buy it. And I, you know, I took it home, and I never looked back. It just pulled me in. I still remember, like, you know, reading The Boogeyman and having nightmares from that. And just looking through the stories, the list of the short stories, and like, yeah, I remember every one of them vividly. And I think I read each of them a couple times. And then my niece, who we were talking about Stranger Things, she got into Stranger Things, and I was like, oh, this is a perfect gateway drug. I can have someone else in the family be a King head. And so for one of her Christmas presents, I bought her Night Shift, and I told her the story of, you know, my mom buying it for me and how much it meant to me, and gave it to her. And she's like, oh, great, this is great. She loves it. She loves Stranger Things. And then a couple months go by, I'm like, how do you like the book? She tried reading the first story and she stopped. And I went back and I looked, I was like, oh yeah, the first story is Jerusalem's Lot. It's like this like H.P. Lovecraftian, like Victorian era, like epistolary, like weird short story. And I was thinking, how did that pull me in? Like, how did like me as 14 reading Jerusalem's Lot, like I too should have like put it down and been like, oh, no, this isn't for me.
Tell her to skip to the other Salem's Lot story in there and do one for the road. That one's way more involving.
Yeah. I told her to skip to Boogeyman and she read that. And then I think she started reading other ones. But
okay, yeah. Good.
So yeah, that was my story. That's how it began. It was just this like terrible covered Night Shift. It was in the early 90s, and all the Stephen King books just have the worst clip art covers. I've just since that moment, it's like, I think I said, it's a complicated relationship where I got really obsessed and was reading as much as I possibly could. And then you get to that high school age, and suddenly, like, I had a conversation with someone, and I'm very curious if other people have this experience of reading King at a young age. You start to get judged by other people. Like, though that's not you know, that's Stephen King. That's not real reading. Like, I felt that criticism, and it made me like second guess my love of King. So I actually put him down and like pretended like it was meaningless and not a part of my life. It wasn't until like I graduated college that I picked up Wizard in Glass and just like, what am I doing? Why am I denying myself? He's a genius, and just the way he writes, he sucks you in. I went back and ever since then, I've just, every time he puts something out, I try to read it. There's a few gaps in there. I actually read Revival because of your podcast. That was another one I'd missed.
You're welcome, by the way.
Yeah, great.
You want to tell you hate it? We get about a 70-30 response rate on that one. We get 70% like love it, thank you, also fuck you for bringing this into my life, and and the 30% going not for me.
Yeah,
you want to hear something funny? Is Scott and I had a mutual friend whose wife passed away, and I didn't know the story till after Scott died, but I'd heard that Scott's response to, like, within a month of his wife passing away, was just like, talking with him and consoling him and all this stuff. It was like, hey, I got a book for you to read, you know, that might take your mind off of things. And he said, Revival. And I don't know if Scott thought about the content of that book, but that was absolutely the wrong time to recommend that. And he came out and he was talking about after Scott passed, he's like, kind of, he was laughing about it, but he was just like, yeah, I didn't think that that story. I'm like, I think he probably would have liked it a little bit better if it wasn't all about, you know, the existential dread of the afterlife being nothing but a hellscape, and and focusing on a character who loses his family right off the bat. You know,
I mean, the thing that really stood out for me for that book is just that is the complete opposite of every other Stephen King book, which is this is never, I'm not the first person to say it, he's, you know, a lot of his endings aren't the best. So thinking about something like The Outsider, which the first half of The Outsider, I think it is one of his strongest books, and I think the second half of The Outsider is one of his weakest books. It's like Revival is the reverse. Like I thought the first third or two thirds of it were kind of a slog, and then I think it's his best ending.
Yeah,
of anything.
Oh, for
sure.
It's
so amazing. It's so, and it just catches you by surprise.
Like, oh, and it's not just the surprise aspect of it, which I think gets all the credit, you know, because it's also a bleak ending, which is also very appealing, I think, for a lot of people that consume a lot of storytelling. I think you find that the people who don't watch a lot of movies or read a lot of books, they're the ones that fucking hate bleak endings. They're the ones that'll fucking show up in IMDb and give a one star to The Mist or something, right? Yeah. But the people who, I think people who do a lot of this shit just love being surprised when the norm is broken, right?
Yeah.
So you have that aspect to it, but like, I think the undersung hero of the ending of Revival, and I'm saying this all as spoiler free as possible, is how all these different threads that have been going through the conversation, through the book, over the decades that story spans, start all coming into play, like things that happened in childhood pay off in a, of course, terrible, awful way. Mm-hmm. And all these hanging threads suddenly become tied off all at the same time as it's, you know, kind of revealed what's beyond the veil. And that's not a pretty sight, you know? So I think that, like, you have King kind of at, like I said, it feels like he's coasting. It's like, but not in the negative way that you would use that word. Like, it just feels like he's free now, you know, he's experimenting with stuff like this. He'll put out a story like The Life of Chuck, you know, he's had spots all over his career. Of course, I'm not saying anything people don't know, where he's like, you know what, I'm going to do my crazy gunslinger, you know, Western sci-fi fantasy horror thing. I'm going to do Eyes of the Dragon. I'm going to write Shawshank and The Body and Elevation. You know, I mean, he's done all these, you know, I don't care, this is interesting to me story. So follow along if you want. You know, that he's done that throughout his career, but like now in particular, it just feels like he's shaken himself free of just being the master of horror and just being like, this is me now. And so if I want to do 9 books about Holly Gibney, then God damn it, I'm going to do 9 books about Holly Gibney. And, you know what I mean? It, like, it just feels like he's in his no shits given, you know, phase.
Yeah.
Right now. So when I say coast, I don't mean that he's being lazy about any of this stuff, by the way. I honestly think that we're living in probably the second best era for, you know, for King outside of his late 70s, early 80s work. Yeah,
I would agree with that. And what is his limit? Like, he sets a goal for himself every day, right? He needs to write an X amount of pages. Is that true? Or am I making that up?
I mean, I think that's changed over the years. I think that it's, I think he said something like 2,000 words or something, or X amount of pages is what I remember him saying in interviews. I don't know if that's still the case or whatnot, but like, yeah, it feels like, you know, he's like Schwarzenegger, where he can't, no matter what happens, he can't help but pump, you know, somewhere. Right. And so no matter what happens, he can't help but write, instead of, you know, psyching out Lou Ferrigno and getting all swole. You know, his version of that is you know, sitting down and writing out stuff. And what's really interesting about that to me is when you're looking at various eras of King, and this maybe is an interesting segue into the topic at hand here, because you talked about Night Shift being like your introductory book, and Skeleton Crew and Night Shift are the two short story collections that really pull from some the previously published stories, mostly Night Shift. Skeleton Crew is like, I say majority of, like, you know, stories of that era, but like Night Shift was him, like, he hit it big. There's a few originals in there, but he's like, here's all the shit that I wrote for magazines to keep my food on the table and the lights on, you know?
Yeah.
That's all collected in one spot. And almost all those stories are very, they're very, you know, Creepshow-esque or EC-esque, and, you know, because they're all being published in these titty magazines, and so they're like way sexier than his usual stuff. There's, you know, they're way darker than his usual stuff, because I think that, you know, with a short story, you're able to be a little bit meaner when they're publishing in a magazine. You know, the people reading that magazine want that sucker punch feel, right? And so. Yeah. So that's what's really interesting to me about his short work, especially of that era. And Grandma does kind of fit in with that. It does feel like, you know, like a segment from Tales from the Crypt, or a story that would have been in one of the early EC books, you know. So,
yeah, which is, I mean, it's a perfect entree for someone that, like, you know, for me finding it at that age, is what they were like sucker punches. And so, you know, I think as I became, came of age and, you know, my reading level like increased and I started wanting more complex, stories, you could start, this was like almost like a tricking me into like the more, you know, like Insomnia, like, or something like Dolores Claiborne, which, you know, I can't imagine reading that as like early high school, like what it actually was about. But, you know, I didn't.
That's got to be somebody's first Stephen King book, right?
I know.
And like, what do they feel like that? Like Gerald's Game. There's a few of them where it's like, that's your first King book and you stuck around. Well, good for you, you know.
Yeah.
And I love those books, by the way. It's not like they're poorly written, but they're not what I think King is like known for. And, you know, they're not what King is known for and what the, you know, what he's, I don't know. They're not the easily accessible. They're not the killer car, killer dog, killer clown, you know, Stephen King.
Yeah. But it's just a testament to his prose and how it just, it pulls you in. Like there's something about the way he writes that it's, you know, you read 20 pages and you don't even feel like you're reading, which it's that's such a rare gift, is that, you know, like, I don't even, it's like magic to for this, that I don't know the scientific reasoning behind, like, you know, the all of the, like, your brain, the way your brain works and processes words, and there's all these steps involved, but to just kind of let go and it's almost like you're watching a movie or something. Yeah. That like I can't like no, this is like the least articulate way of describing this process, but yeah, like I'm always kind of seeking out authors that have that kind of similar prose that it's probably, I mean, he's called it himself like the book equivalent of a Big Mac and fries, like that those just they go down very easy and
right. I think he dismisses his own work a bit by labeling it as such. But I totally understand the comparison, and I agree that it's immensely readable. You know, I've said multiple times on the show that for it can kind of ruin me for other writers, right? It's like, especially when I was a kid, you know, you read King as a kid and you go, this is what books are. This is just what books are. And then you read anybody else, and I'm legit, and I'm talking about like some of the best authors that have ever existed. You know, there's a barrier of entry to Moby Dick for me, right? Like I can't just jump into that thing. I actually have to be hardcore focused on, you know, and thinking about the language as it's happening, or else I just lose my spot and I wander. Right.
Yeah.
But King has that. It's not, there's just, however he puts his words together, it's like he lays like little hooks into it, and you don't realize that you're spending your evening reading, and suddenly you're a third of the way through the book because you couldn't put it down, kind of stuff. Which, you know, I don't know, that I guess you could also say reality TV is that way. You know, it hooks you and you whatever, but those feel like empty calories where King doesn't. Even with the schlockier stuff, like there's an emphasis on character and craft in his work that doesn't leave you feeling like, you know, I don't know, oh, these are guilty pleasure kind of things. But I guess that kind of goes back to what you were talking about, is being kind of embarrassed as a kid to feel lesser because you're reading Stephen King, which isn't real reading. Mm-hmm. Which I don't know if that would exist now. I think now almost any school would be just happy that their kids are reading and not just fucking around on their phones or iPads or whatever. But but back in the day, like I remember being really special when I found teachers that like embraced my reading of King and it would like recommend titles and stuff to me. And that kind of was few and far between.
Yeah. And it's, you know, to be fair, like I think any of the people that criticized my King reading, I guarantee you none of them had ever read anything that he'd written. It was just dismissing like, oh, this is the guy that had, because you would be with like my that time, you know, you'd be watching TV at like 2 a.m. and then there like the Stephen King Book of the Month Club would come on. You know, it was right. It's just like it was. You know, for the masses type of marketing, but like I truly believe that he's a genius, and yeah, fuck all those people.
Yeah, fuck them. They're all. Nobody's gonna remember them. So yes, you pick Grandma as your story. There's a lot to dive into with this, and I particularly want to talk about, you know, that there are a few stories that have come up a few times on the shows, people wanting to pick and talk about. And this is one that keeps coming up. And I'm really curious to dive into the why. Are there like a handful of stories that everybody keeps gravitating towards? But before we do that, I want to refresh everybody's memory. Would you be so kind as to just give a brief summary of what the story is in case people don't remember it? You don't have to go beat by beat or anything, but if you want to just kind of remind people which story we're talking about here.
Yeah, the story is Grandma. It's from Skeleton Crew, and it's like whatever the short story equivalent of a bottle episode would be. It's a self-contained story. It all takes place pretty much in one house. It's a boy who's stuck. His mom and his older brother are gone, and he's stuck alone in this house with his bedridden grandma. And it's, you know, Do I just talk through the whole story? Do you want me to spoil it? I guess we're going to be talking about it.
Yes. If you just want to,
of course,
you know, to give the broad strokes now, we can do it that way. But however you want to do it, sometimes that's the guest prerogative. Like, I remember we had Alex Winter on the show and we asked him to describe like the plot of, you know, it was like the Dead Zone, or it was, I don't remember what it was, but it was something where it's like, you can just say, oh yeah, it's the one where the guy gets in a car accident and then wakes up and can touch people and see things. He could have done that.
Yeah.
But instead he spent about 30 minutes going like, and then this happened, and then this happened, which is interesting in and of itself. So however you want to approach it, you're totally free. You can do the Alex Winter version, or you can do the that's all the setup that you need. So it's all up to you.
Yeah. I mean, I the only thing I would add is, I mean, it's a very simple story, which is he's stuck at home alone with his bedridden grandma, and it slowly becomes obvious that this woman is a witch who is wanting to take over her grandson's body. And it's you know, two people in the story. It's very, the thing I love about it, the thing I love about it now is different from what I loved about it as a kid. But what I love about it now is I love self-contained stories. I love one location stories. It's something that I always think about, like, would make a great adaptation. And I'm like, oh, I should adapt this. I should write a script version of this. But those are the times I forget that the movie Hereditary exists. And then I remember, oh shoot, Hereditary is very similar from this. And I'll forget about Hereditary and I'll be like, oh, I should adapt Grandma. And then, you know, slowly realize,
then you start looking at it and going, yeah. Okay, so I'm making Hereditary. Yeah,
exactly. But I'm sure there's, you know, you get enough distance from it. And if I could figure out like a, some kind of spin or twist on it, that might be more interesting. Cause there was a Twilight Zone episode that I also saw as a kid that scared the bejesus out of me with the kid from Neverending Story.
Yeah. Oliver Barrett. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And I remember that scared me, and I watched that recently, and it's like the whole, they use him doing voiceover the entire time, which to me takes you out of the really takes away from the scariness of a kid being alone. You want to like really be in the silences and like what it's like to be a kid in a house by yourself with an adult that's not one of your parents, like that. Yeah. That I think that as a kid reading that, because I was probably around the same age. I mean, he's 11 in the book, but I would have been like 13 or 14.
Yeah.
That's why it scared me so much, because it's, you know, it's essentially me in a creepy house with a witch. And it gave me nightmares. I think that and the boogeyman are the two that I think stuck with me the most.
Right.
Yeah,
no, there's something about this story that, like I mentioned earlier, that grabs people. It's something that has been requested. We don't often do short story focused episodes and here in the main feed. That's usually more of a Patreon thing. But when we do, there's been a couple that people gravitate towards. The Raft is one. And Grandma's another, the Monkey is becoming fairly popular, and I think it'll only become more popular if the Osgood Perkins movie ends up being as good as I think it's gonna be.
Yeah, well, it's a very fun trailer. I can't wait to see it.
Yeah.
And the Raft. I like, you know, not a huge fan of Creepshow too, but I think that adaptation is very effective.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, that final gut punch, you know, of that, like I'll always remember that. And it's so funny how clunky it kind of feels now revisiting Creepshow 2. In my mind, I had it built up as this giant tidal wave that, you know, I don't know. It's when you're a kid and you watch something and it just takes on this mythological, you know, thing in your mind, especially if it's effective.
You watch it now and you're like, oh, it's just a garbage bag.
Yeah, they're just pulling a garbage bag over that guy. you know, but when you're, you know, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old and you're watching Creepshow 2, a lot of the, you know, the racism aspect of, you know, Chief Woodenhead,
yeah,
and, you know, all the political and sociological, you know, underpinnings, that didn't get me. I didn't fucking understand how rapey the raft was, but, you know, 10, 12 year old me, it was just like boobies, you know, there's boobies and scary thing in water. You know, that's all that I really thought about. But yeah, when those things affect you, like they take on this like oversized, like I said, mythological quality, you know, in your mind. But Grandma's, it's an interesting one to me. And I have seen that Twilight Zone. We're talking about the 80s reboot that Harlan Ellison spearheaded. They adapted it for that. And it's a tough fucking choice there. And I understand why they had to do the narration, because the story is all in George's head. Mm-hmm. And it's not just him being alone. It's like him combing through his memories and rediscovering essentially the plot and telling everybody, oh yeah, like all these breadcrumbs have been dropped all throughout George's life of, you know, of the family acting differently around, you know, the mom and her getting kicked out of her church because of being obsessed with occult books and believing that that's how she had her family was because, you know, that she, you know, there was something wrong with her ability to procreate, and all she wanted was a giant family, and she ended up getting it, but at what, you know, what bargain did she make to get it, and all this stuff, you know, which is, it's one, it's a little bit of writerly bullshit, you know, because no kid remembers all that shit, as we talked about. Like my memory now is so crappy, I couldn't remember conversations I had 2 weeks ago versus little, you know, as a kid where he's like, I remember when I was six and there was this conversation that my grandma and my mom and my auntie had, you know. It's a little bit of writerly bullshit, but it's also true. That's kind of how you when you're a kid and you're starting, you piece together shit in the world, you're looking at the world, you know, for real, at that age when you're 11, 12, 13 years old. That's when you're starting to piece shit together and, you know, and take the context clues of stuff you've lived through and maybe logged away in your memory, but never fucking, you know, looked at close enough to make sense yet. Now all the dots are starting to connect. I get that. And it feels true. And that's kind of how the story's written. And also when you're making like a 30-minute show out of that, you gotta be telling a lot, I guess, instead of showing. But I can see what you mean though. There is something if they had decided to do what they did with that Battleground episode of the TNT Nightmares and Dreamscapes series, where you made this the silent one, where not silent in terms of audio, but silent in terms of no dialogue, you know, where the mom, maybe you treat it like Peanuts or something, where you'd never really see the mom character or whatnot, and you just hear her talk off screen, and then it's just him there, you know, alone with the grandma, and it just becomes this tension, you know, not no dialogue tension, you know.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I mean, I think I think that would be really interesting, almost like a really quiet, small, but tapping into childhood fears of long shadows and creaky, you know, floorboards and you know,
and old people.
And old people, yeah. It's also a time in when you're, you know, confronted with this idea of aging and death and what that means, and how scary it is. This idea that your grandparents are slowly withering away, and the fear of also it being behind a closed door and not knowing what's happening behind that. That's like just powerful imagery. I don't think that would probably, you know, if it were to adapt into a feature film, like that would be a little, you'd be testing your audience's patience for just how quiet and silent it would be. You'd have to like,
right.
I wouldn't rely on voiceover for that, but, you know, cut in and out to the past. And so it's like essentially what he's thinking and remembering, but you could play into that and all the elements that went into the kind of setting up this moment too, like I don't think it's presented in the book that the grandma is responsible for the brother, because does the brother like breaks his leg?
Yeah,
and that's why the mom is
called
gone.
Away. Yeah.
Yeah,
he breaks a leg at sports or whatever, and you also find out that George is the main character, and his brother have a very I'd say toxic relationship. The older brother is very much a bully to the younger one, and you know the younger one's the kid that's good at school and the nerdy one, and you have the jock, you know, older brother. Was being shitty, and which comes into play later. And this is something that when we talk about the ending of Grandma, it becomes clear that through these occult books or and whatnot that she has what they call bad spells. And this is one of the goofier elements of the story, where he realizes that when they're mentioning that grandma had a bad spell and she was speaking in tongues and whatnot, it's not like what you would think of as a bad spell. She's literally saying a negative spell, you know,
yeah.
And she's cursing somebody, and that somebody, and all she has to do is repeat some shit, and then somebody half the fucking world away will drop dead of a heart attack or whatnot. So, you kind of get this feeling that she's super powerful, and then she dies and then comes back to give him a hug. And that's not like a zombie hug. This is her spirit. You know, she's choosing to get out of this form and be put into the, you know, she wants to put herself into George, and live, you know, throughout the, you know, a whole new lifetime, which then you understand where the hereditary conversation, you know, comes into this. I'd dying to know if Ari Aster knows this story, or if he would admit to it, or if this is just a happenstance, because it is like Hereditary is the A24 adaptation of Grandma. And it's so crazy looking at the two together.
I can't imagine that he's not aware of it, just how popular it is and how similar it is. Not saying he ripped it off at all. I'm a gigantic fan of the movie Hereditary. And it is the A24 version of Grandma. I don't think I could put it any more perfect. I don't know if it's a case of just subconsciously like using these themes, or if this is just naturally what one would do if you're writing a story about, you know, what we pass on to our kids and aging and death, and, you know, throw a witch in there. And
and you know, George is in that coming of age period himself, and you know, changing and not taking shit from his brother and all that stuff, which is the note the story ends on. I don't remember if the adaptation, at least the Twilight Zone version, because there's a movie version of this as well, by the way.
Yeah, I didn't know about that till today. I looked it up. It's called Mercy. I never heard of it. Yeah.
Yeah, so the kid from Super 8 and the kid from Walking Dead, I think, are the two brothers. And I've never watched the movie beginning to end either. Like, I think I've watched every piece in pieces. I don't think it's very good. It's not one that has hooked me, but one day I'll revisit it. I probably should have done it for this episode, but I re-listened to the short story via audiobook. So I did some homework for this.
Yeah.
But the ending...
I'm curious about that. The Mercy, I don't want to give too much space for Mercy, but like, how did they, if you like cover, is it all take place like in the house that night? Is there?
No, I mean, that's not my memory of it. Again, I've only seen pieces here or there. And I think that I've tried to watch it multiple times and I always end up halfway through fucking around on my phone and like, I just can't pay attention.
Okay. Well, I'll save my questions
when I do
the Mercy podcast.
Yes. It's all over. It's like there's weeks and shit leading up to it, and like back and forth, and the brother is like there with him and all this. So I mean, it's a radically changed story, but no, it's not just the kid alone with the dying grandma. Because there's a lot of really good stuff there with that simple premise that you would think would make it would be the knee jerk way into an adaptation, right? But that's apparently not. Apparently, The answer to adapting it is to make it more like the Book of Henry or something. I don't know. But one thing that I think that is interesting is that the story itself isn't ambiguous in how it ends. It is very clear that the grandma does succeed in getting her spirit into the child. And I think that there's an interesting take that you can do where it's ambiguous where you're not sure, but like, it's kind of, I don't know if that's as good or if it's just like a nice little, you know, thought of how you could change things up and make the audience think. But, you know, I don't know if it's worth giving up that like kind of chilling inner dialogue or whatever of George going like really looking forward to a shithead brutal bully brother coming in. And go on like now I've got the power.
I think that you would be, if you wanted to go with the ambiguous ending, you'd be sacrificing kind of like the coolest moment of that, which is like the payback and through it being, the spirit of his grandma is such a fun ending and, maybe why it wouldn't work in a movie. Cause this conversation is making me think about like, what I want from a short story versus what I want from a novel. And typically I think I like the dour endings on short stories. Like they're more effective and powerful and they're that sucker punch, but you spend, you know, hundreds of pages with a novel and you don't want to also be left in a sour mood after you've committed so much time to these characters.
Right. Do you think George is still mostly George, or do you think he is 100% grandma? Because it kind of reads like this is George plus grandma now, you know, and he's been kind of infected with her cruelty and selfishness and whatnot. But I also, you know, I don't think grandma's sitting there going, I can't wait to get revenge on one of my grandkids. Like, but like George, this is something he's always wanted. Now he has the power to do it. So yeah. I think that he's still in there. I think he's not just completely replaced. He's not the innocent boy replaced by the evil spirit. I think it's him, you know, it's like him mixed with grandma now is whatever this new entity is.
Yeah, no, I think I totally agree with that. Like, what would grandma get gain from, like, you know, picking on an older brother? Because that's never been set up that the brother has had this contentious relationship with the grandma. If it had been set up that, like, the grandma and the older brother didn't get along and the brother, like, you know, hated her, then I would say, yeah, that would be proper payback. Yeah. But it's fully through George's eyes. And so, you know, like, that makes... That's just such a... Then I want to see the sequel. I want to see Georgie grandma combo, the Voltron.
As long as he keeps his clothes on, because that little fucking weirdo decides whenever he gets the grandma spirit, like King describes him as just stripping down naked and laying in bed with the moon washed over his body, and he's just like soaking it all in. He's just daydreaming about getting revenge on his older brother, and he has the power to do that now. So as long as you keep your clothes on, George, that's all I'm saying. Yeah. It's not appropriate. I mean, I guess if you're going to get naked, the best place to get naked is your own bedroom, but you know, but still, you know, just
it's a choice.
You know, let's not get crazy here. This isn't a French film, you know.
Yeah,
you
it's keep them clothes, you know, on. I think about, you know, Stephen King made some odd choices with, you know, the way he ended it in the book. that always comes to mind.
Yeah, there's an interesting, you know, I don't know, path to go down with how Stephen King deals with, you know, because you can deals with coming of age, and that's essentially what this is. It's like, you know, you can also take away the supernatural stuff and, you know, have this be, this was a, you know, an adult test, the first of real adult test that he had to do, where he's in a situation where he can't lean on adults. And this is, you know, does he pass the test when his grandma passes away, and he has to deal with that and being responsible for, you know, looking after and all that stuff. And then, you know, so you can easily peel back the supernatural stuff and say, you know, that's just, you know, symbolically him, you know, embracing the different version of himself that we all have whenever, you know, we hit puberty and we go on to the next stage of our lives. Right. And we leave childhood behind and become adults. Yeah. So it's real easy to, you know, to go, okay, it's not him being creep. It's not like he's spending like eight paragraphs talking about this kid's dork or anything. He's not like, you know, there is one really weird spot where he gets goosebumps at a certain point. And in order to illustrate that, in the writing, King describes this kid as like reaching it under her shirt and touching his nipple and going, man, the nipple's hard. So, you know, it must be, it's like, is that your go-to whenever you get goosebumps? Do you judge its effectiveness by touching your own nipples? Because I don't, but
I'm sorry that there's going to be yard work. I forgot. Monday morning. I don't know if that's going to affect the recording. I can hear it.
I don't really hear it.
Getting closer. It's not quite here yet. He's going to be next to my, there's a leaf blower that might affect this. So that's, I don't know. Right.
It's all right. Yeah. So there might be some garden sounds. That's just how podcasts do in the year of our Lord 2024, y'all. So, nice try to dodge the question about touching nipples, but you need to answer this question before we can move on.
I think it's integral to the story, and if I adapted it, I would probably spend a fair amount of time on nipple touching. That's my answer. It has to be in the story.
When you bring that up, I immediately think of like Ren and Stimpy, where you're just gonna have those like fucking brutal like cut-ins to to like the most disgusting fucking like hyper close ingrown hairs around the nipples and shit. It's like we're gonna see Granny's nipples dragging on the ground. Yeah,
I mean, I think about the end of It. I think about it all the time because you know, you're doing this like multi, however many, like $200 million movie. Adaptation of this book, I would just want to be a fly on the wall for the meetings, like the people in the boardroom talking about, okay, well, like, are we, what do we do about this scene, the way this book ends? That's a weird tangent, but I do think about because I reread it recently, and it's worse than I remember.
I don't need to necessarily relitigate the ending of this on the show, but you know what I will say is when we've had people like Emily V. Gordon on to talk about that specific title, of course you can't talk about it the book without, you know, talking about the sewer train that happens. You know, she put it into context, you know, when she came on, that I think has helped me grapple with that a bit. And that is essentially how, from, you know, from her perspective, reading it when she was that age and reading it now with, you know, a degree in child psychology, she thinks that it's an extremely healthy sequence as kids that age are not only, you know, having feelings and whatnot, that when you look at it from a literary perspective, that you're seeing that this is when Beverly is taking control of her sexuality. And it's actually a very powerful thing. Nobody's forcing her to do anything. She's been objectified by her father. She's been objectified by Henry Bowers. You know, everybody has wanted to use her body in this story for other, darker, horrible purposes. And this is her giving herself her agency and doing it and being in control of it. And when, you know, you read it that way, yeah, it's, you know, I get it. And you know, and also as a kid, when I read it when I was the age of the losers, you know, it's something that it didn't stand out to me as being icky. It was like, oh my God, this is happening. It feels icky now when you're, you know, when I'm a 40 plus year old man who's reading about a bunch of kids and having sex in a sewer. It's definitely not comfortable as an adult reading it. But you know, that's also not the point of this, you know, the point of the scene. And considering what it is and that it's all told from Beverly's point of view, I tend to lean on Emily's reading of it to not make me feel so gross about it.
No, I mean, that sounds like a really elegant, articulate way of explaining it. And I'm going to listen to that episode.
You should. Yeah. Emily V. Gordon, very smart person. Yeah. Much smarter than me. And I'm glad that she comes on the show to talk about shit like this so I can then repeat her words and people go, you know what? That sounds smart. Kids and Sexuality in King is there's a whole fucking college paper to be written on that. I'm sure that if
I'm sure there are already many of them. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, thankfully, you know, there's, you know, all jokes about touching nipples aside in this. Ah, there's that leaf blower.
Yep, it's here. It's right next to my window. Bear with me. I apologize.
It's all good. But yeah, like all jokes about touching nipples aside, it's, you know, the story is fairly asexual. There's not really any like undercurrent of like you, I suppose you could say that there's maybe a you know, he could be tackling the idea of suppressed memory and molestation and the hug is more than a hug and all that stuff. You could probably give that reading, but I don't think that that's what he was going for at all here. I think this is King in this era, especially is doing a lot of, you know, he likes to write a lot about, especially adult figures changing and becoming something that they're not and becoming threatening and scary. And I, you know, I think that that's just something that when King, who writes kids so well, you know, he remembers that feeling. You talked about it, about, you know, being alone with an adult who isn't, you know, your parents and how you're on edge and all this stuff. He, for whatever reason, King remembers that shit really well from childhood. And that's why I think his kids, the protagonists and whatnot in his books, you know, are so well drawn, is because I think he remembers what it's actually like to be a kid. And so
it never feels like he's infantilizing or making kids younger than they are, which I think is a lot of like an easy trap to fall into, is kids are smarter than we give them credit for. And I think he just, the way he draws them, it's with a lot of respect and care. Yeah.
Yep. So so what do you think about the occult angle to the story? Like you get like a lot of backstory about grandma being like kicked out of her church and whatnot. And like, so you get one thing I like about the occult thing in the story is that you get all this, like these little glimpses about like, which could be its own book of, you know, this woman who just wanted to have a family and she finds these occult books and she starts saying some fucking H.P. Lovecraft shit about the like Shoggoths and whatnot. And then suddenly she can have kids, but that also, you know, kind of turned her into this fucking cruel old woman that, you know, can get pissed off and like what and there's also this whole thing that this layer to it. Sorry, I've asked one question, now I'm already moving on to another topic, but we can roll these into one thing. But there's another layer of it, is like, what if somebody with that power gets dementia? And so you have something like they approach that in Logan very well with Professor X, like what happens to somebody with his kind of powers when he has dementia, and you see the danger that is. And so what happens to somebody who's, you know, kind of this occult master and can, like I said, fucking do a chant and cause somebody to have a heart attack, you know, on the other side of the world. It's like, like what happens to that person? What happens to Eleven when she's, you know, got dementia in a nursing home? You know, it's like,
yeah,
what kind of, you know, chaos can happen there? And I love all this. I love all those glimpses you get. So what do you think about the occult angle and all the like little teeny tiny windows into like the grandma story itself?
I mean, my, you know, my writer brain is like, well, there's also an interesting way of coming to the story where you could do, you know, almost like a two-hander where you do the story of Georgie left alone with grandma, and it's intercut with like grandma's story. So this bad guy is actually kind of humanized with her story, which, you know, the fact that she can't have kids, I think it's a very, that's a very sad backstory that kind of shines a different light on the ending. It's still, you know, like occult stuff to me, it's like, that's just window dressing. Like, I'm not really like that interested in like the, you know, spell books and that kind of, you know, that those elements. But, you know, I do think if you, the dementia angle, I think kind of softens the story just a tad bit, which is like, the scariness is that this is pre-planned. This is like kind of preordained. Like, she is going to take over this guy, this
this kid's body. And that to me is the scariest part about it. Like all the events that you discover are set in motion for this night. So that she can, you know, move on within his body. So the idea of the dementia being like part of it too, I think it's interesting, but I don't know. I don't know if that belongs in this story, this version of the story, or the version I would want to adapt. But that's also that to me is like, could be another great story, is what would happen if a witch had dementia and, you know, she her powers start out of her control, start manifesting in ways that, you know, are affecting her loved ones unintentionally.
Right.
I think that'd be awesome.
I think we had Mark Bernardin, I believe, on the show, who he wrote for Castle Rock a bit. And you know, there's a character in there that Sissy Spacek plays. And he told me that, or he told us when he came on the show, that one of his pitches was that it was going to be for season two, if they hadn't done the Annie Wilkes thing, was that they wanted to have Sissy be revealed as actually Carrie White, and that she had survived or whatever, and she had actually gone to, you know, had her name changed and all this stuff, and she kind of forgot who she was, and then she has dementia, and what happens when Carrie White has dementia, you know, which is in the similar vein, I guess, as saying like Eleven or, you know, or the grandma in this story. You know, I don't know. It's very interesting. You know, what happens when you lose those faculties? Yeah. And
why didn't they do it? That sounds.
I know how fucking rad would it have been?
Yeah.
No, I think that, you know, one, I don't know if they could have talked Carrie, if they could have talked Sissy into actually playing Carrie White again. That might have been a bridge too far. But you know, but I don't know. I think it's, you know, I love the pitch. I love the idea. I love the whole concept of you know, the how you can read this story differently depending on your age, because, you know, obviously when I first read it, I was the age of the main character. I'm not a grandma yet. I'm not reaching grandma years yet, but I remember hearing like adults say kind of quasi creepy shit when I was in my 20s and stuff, like where I'd go to like say the you know, get my hair cut, and they're like, everybody would like be gushing over how like, wow, your hair's so thick and you know, great, like you know, cherish it. And now, as you know, a thinning you know, middle-aged man, I go, okay, so that's what they were talking about. But it was weird as like a 19-year-old hearing, you know, some,
yeah, they're coveting your hair,
coveting your hair. And you hear people say, like, talk about, oh my god, you're, you know, the skin, oh my, the skin is so, you look so, you know, nice or whatever. And now, like, I'm reaching the age where I'm like starting to notice that too. I'm just like, oh man, I wish I had that person's skin. I'm like, oh fuck, I'm turning into grandma, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, let's make it grandma from grandma's point of view. Cause my brain immediately, my writer brain is tingling. Cause if she's dabbling with the occult, you could say that she definitively knows that there's no afterlife. You know, you add this idea that, oh, once you die, there's nothing. And what the lengths you would go to stay alive, and would you inhabit your grandson's body if you could be like, versus, you know, going into sinking into nothingness. That would be fun.
Hmm. And do you think that she, it's weird, if Brian Fuller was here right now, we'd probably be talking about the I don't know, parallels between her choosing to become a young boy as an older woman, you know, and you know, maybe some trans allegory stuff here. But do you think that grandma cares, or she just wants youth? Like, if she would have been just as fine, because in like something like Hereditary, it's like written down that was it Pan, I think, is the god.
Something similar to Pan.
Yeah. Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
Whatever the evil entity there specifically wanted a male, even though the grandma was trying to like have the girl be the person. I don't know. It gets vague and weird, but like when you actually look at the thing, like he specifically wants a boy. And you know, and that it's that's, you know, what happens to the kid and that thing. But here I don't think that my read, and you know, maybe correct me if I'm wrong, or correct me if you have a different opinion. I don't think that this grandma really cares that she just wants the youth. She wants the vitality. She wants the life. Not that she was sitting there going, damn it, you know, I don't have granddaughters. I just have these grandsons. So I'm going to have to settle for this. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, she obviously had a choice between the two, which is two boys. You take the shithead or do you take the quiet, like smart one? So she probably is picking the juicier one. And by the way, it's Payman. That's the
Payman. That's right.
Payman. Yeah, like she's not really shaded as someone who is having a deep moral quandary about taking over her grandson. She is like all in on it. So I think you're right in assuming that he's available. It's like that he's probably weak and easier to take as a vessel, or I don't know.
And if he's a cooler fucking kid, and he seems to be the cooler of the two kids, especially if my theory holds water that whatever the resulting personality is, some sort of new, you know, blended up mixture between George and grandma, and not just grandma herself in his body. You know, and then she's going to want the cooler kid is all I'm saying. Cause she's, you know, that's going to be part of her personality now.
True. And what is Georgie grandma like in college? What's he like? I just want a continuation of the story to see where grandma's taking Georgie.
And what, yeah. That's a sequel with the
adventures they're going on.
The adventures of grandma and Georgie. You can see like a Homeward Bound kind of trailer set up for it. Yeah. Well, I don't know if I have too much more to talk about on grandma. Is there any other aspect of the story you wanna touch on before we wrap things up?
No, I think that we covered most of it, and you know, one day maybe I will crack it. But there's a reason it's stuck with me, and there's a reason it's stuck with so many people. I think it's in its simplicity of this, like it just taps into, you know, all your childhood fears. Yeah, nothing new to add.
Nice. Well, before we wrap up, I want to give you a little chance to plug your movie that you have coming up. I apologize. You're coming on a few months before your movie comes out, so hopefully it sticks in people's minds enough that they remember the chat. But tell us when people can see your movie and tell us a little bit about what it's about. You have a fucking killer cast, so.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, the movie is called Companion, and it comes out January 31st. Can't really talk a lot about it without spoiling it, but you know, the story, you can watch the teaser. The teaser's out right now, but it's essentially with three couples.
You mean motherfucker, you set Sophie Thatcher on fire in the trailer, I thought.
Yes. It's just three couples go to a big mansion in the middle of nowhere and shit goes wrong. I wouldn't want to say more than that. It's constantly kind of reinventing itself, I would say, like as you're, it's, you know, you, the, I don't think the trailer really, the teaser that's out now really like showcases like all of the genres it hits on. It's more the horror side of that, but there's action elements, there's a heist element, there's relationship drama is a big part of it. It's a tough one to talk about, and I don't know if we're kind of in this weird gray area right now where we're talking to Warner Brothers about because eventually there will have to be a full trailer that's revealed, and how much of the story will it reveal, and how much can we get away with just teasing and this day and age? I don't know, when there's so much content that you're competing against, if you can get away with just being like, hey, trust us, come see this movie because it's cool. I don't know if you can do pull quote trailers anymore, and that we'll see.
If it's a shocking kind of thing, you just need to do like revisit those TV spots and trailers that would just have like reactions of people, like what, just screen it a bunch and then react to, you get people reacting to it.
Yeah, we're having our Beyond Fest screening tonight, actually. So we'll see. We'll see how that goes. Maybe we'll get some good ideas of where we can take the marketing. But yeah, we're not going to get what Long Legs had, which is like the ultimate pull quote, which is scariest movie of the decade. We're not going to get that. Uh-huh. It's not.
A, well,
it's
I can say that right scary now. Movie.
Yeah, say it right now. We'll put you on the poster, and we'll see you. I'll see you at
little
the bank.
Asterisk. he hasn't seen it yet, but
yeah,
you need that Crazy People quote. Do you ever watch that movie, Crazy People?
Remind me which Crazy
this
People?
This is Dudley Moore and Daryl Hannah. It's an 80s movie or late 80s maybe movie, and it's all about a advertising guy who goes.
Yes, I've seen Crazy People. Yes.
Yeah,
I watched it last year. I don't know. And that's how forgettable it is. I forgot that I'd seen it. I watched it last year.
It's such
and he starts telling the truth, right? Like all the ads are like,
yeah, that's
true.
When he loses his mind. He starts telling the truth and he starts building up these ad campaigns that are honest. And that will take the shit or the take the piss out of the sponsors and shit. And they get furious and accidentally, you know, he sent away to a mental institution, an honest ad.
As where you end up if you start telling the truth,
the truth in advertising. Yeah. But then his ad campaigns go out by accident and they become hugely popular. And so then the ad company goes back to him while he's in the nut house and he's falling in love with crazy, quote unquote, crazy Daryl Hannah. And they go back to the nut house and try to recruit him to come back to work. And he ends up bringing all of his newfound inmate friends along. And then they start just coming up with the most fucking ridiculous ad campaigns. And I still think about like some, there's one for Volvo. Where it's like boxy, but good. You know, it's like you little things like that. But the what always jumps to mind and the reason why I brought it up is they're asked to come up with a quote for a horror movie in there. And it said, this movie won't just scare you. It'll fuck you up for life.
Yes.
And then like that, I think that's the one that gets out there by accident. And like, then people are just lined up around the block to watch this movie all these like reporters are interviewing people online and they're going like, I don't know. I heard it's going to fuck me up for life and I have to see what the hell this movie's going to be. So
that's a
good
strategy.
You just need your Crazy People quote. You know, it's a long
crazy
way.
Crazy People quote. Yes. And also I have this, I think it's supposed to be a great marketing angle too. Is like everything's a sequel these days. Like the top 10 movies of 2024 are all sequels. Like literally every single movie in the top 10 are a sequel.
Yeah.
Just call it Companion 2 and we'll see what happens. And
Companion episode 4.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, wonderful. I wish you luck with it.
Thank you.
You know, you have an incredible cast. I think Jack Quaid is one of the most fascinating actors of his generation, and he's just so fucking charismatic. Your eye is always drawn to him on screen. I think he's great. And then Sophie Thatcher is just fucking killing it. Like every time she pops up in something, you know it's quality. So
yeah, she's the best. She
Book
really
of Boba Fett aside, but that wasn't her fault.
Yeah. No, the cast, we really, really lucked out. Like our cast is fantastic. And I can't imagine the movie without any of them. So, and they're all just sublime, wonderful people to work with too.
Nice. Well, yeah. I wish you the best of luck with that release and have a lot of fun at your screening tonight. And thanks for coming on and chatting some Stephen King shit with me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for putting up with my long rambling. Steve, like, really was such a big part of my life that, and I'm doing it now. I'm just rambling more and more and more. But yeah, it's tough for me to like come up with like a really cogent thought about King because it's just, he's just such a large percentage of my brain. So thank you for having me and listening to my bullshit.
Anytime, man. Many thanks to Drew Hancock for joining me for that discussion. I'm kind of chomping at the bit to see his flick, Companion, but I will have to wait, like all of us, for it to come out at the end of January. But many thanks again, Drew, for coming on, especially this early. Anyway, I had a great time chatting with the man, and I wish him all the best. Before I sign off, it's once again time to plug the Patreon. You know the drill at this point, so I won't give you the hard sell, but we do have a great community over there. That's patreon.com/thekingcast. Sign up now, throw the show a few bucks a month, and you'll get rewarded with bonus episodes, commentaries, and access to our rowdy, but I must stress, very safe, Discord. So you definitely want to come hang out with all of us freaks over there. It's a fun time. And again, we know it's a lot to ask to sign up for yet another monthly subscription, but we do our best to make it worth your while. Patreon.com/thekingcast. And yeah, that should do it. Until next week, adios, folks.
The Kingcast is a Fangoria podcast production. The show is produced, hosted, and created by Eric Vespi, that's me, and Scott Wampler. Tira Ansley and Abhi Goel are executive producers. Daniel Danger is our art director, and editing is done by yours truly.